This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Stacy Williams. Stacy manages the University of Kentucky's Learning Lab, which is an archives internship program. You can find her on Twitter at Rybrarian, W-R-I-B-R-A-R-I-A-N. Stacy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So you are an archivist and a librarian, of course, working at University of Kentucky. I just wanted to get sort of the backstory of how did you originally get started in librarianship? What got you interested in librarianship in the first place, and then the specialty of archives?
So I was a journalist. I was a journalist for about 11 years. And at that time, it was just before the recession had gotten into full swing. But what I was seeing a lot of, certainly at that time, you know, media was another one of those fields in which disruptive technology had changed a lot of things. So just before the recession, I was starting to see these sort of large scale layoffs. And what I was really struck by also was a lot of older people kind of saying, oh, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do with the rest of my life now if I'm not a journalist. So I just kind of felt like, gosh, I really don't want to be in that situation. I don't want to be, you know, 40 or 50 years old and, you know, possibly get laid off and then be feeling like, I don't know what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. So it kind of started there where I just felt like perhaps I need an additional skill. So I was really racking my brain because I didn't want to totally have to reinvent the wheel in terms of skills that I had new skills that I would need to acquire. I wasn't going to jump up and become an astronaut. So I was searching for things that I felt that I could do well, but also be passionate about. And librarianship, honestly, it was weird. It was almost like somebody whispered it into my ear or something. I was at a journalism conference watching everybody secretly freak out about what was happening in the field at that time. And I was talking with friends and it was like all of a sudden it just popped into my head, libraries. And it was so weird. It seemed so obvious. And I don't know why it had never occurred to me before that. Never occurred to me before that. And so immediately I started looking into it and researching programs and researching fields of study. I think I saw more about what I could do with the current skill set that I had. And I had always been certainly a longtime lover of books and reading and literacy and, grew up going to the library all the time. I think how I fell into archives was kind of feeling like, all right, here is something in the field that is somewhat of a specialization. I spent some time volunteering at different types of libraries and archives. I had a bunch of really interesting library experiences before I actually started my program. And I think I was compelled by some of the larger implications in archives, mostly this idea of, I'm compelled by the idea of patterns in history and being able to sort of chart those patterns. Some archivists will tell you, like, they really love the old stuff. Like, they love, you know, looking at the old letters and seeing the daguerreotypes and I find those things interesting, but I also really find it fascinating to see some of these things that we just sort of keep doing over and over and over again. And maybe the format changes, maybe the metadata changes, but that we essentially, humanity keeps doing these things over and over.
Right. History repeating itself.
history always repeating itself. So I think I liked archives for the idea, because of the idea that it would allow me to explore that further.
Well, what's interesting, of course, is that you jumped from a career that was disrupted by tech into another career that was disrupted by tech.
I know. I had crazy timing. The timing was really, that's what it was. I think I probably had been one of those people who read the predictions like, oh, there's just going to be so many library jobs left. The profession is graying. So I was certain I had read that and thought like, oh, great. And then jumped right into another situation that had been disrupted by technology, disrupted by the recession. But I think one of the ways in which I had a bit of an advantage was simply that I'd been working for all that time prior. I essentially had a whole other career with many of the same skills. I utilize many of the same skills. And I know what is different now is that the field is certainly trending younger. You know, I think when I first got in, I'd been told that librarianship was one of those things that was a second career for most people. So I probably fit in with that particular demographic, but the field is skewing younger. You have more and more people who come, you know, straight into it directly from, you know, they go straight from undergrad to grad school and then they hop right into it. So I think maybe that was one of the differences that ended up helping me in a way, even though we were still just coming out of the recession.
How do you feel like archives in particular have embraced technology? Do you feel like they're doing a lot? It seems like in your job, you do a lot with technology.
That is an interesting question. I think that archives that are well-funded and that, either yes. well-funded or, and that's, you know, maybe funds are key for everybody, but I think that those that are well-funded and that have sort of forward-thinking people on staff try their very best to integrate technology in a way that is as relevant as possible for our users. I mean, our patrons are a little bit different. It's different from being at a public library and saying, okay, well, we're going to provide, you know, like a digital lab where everybody can use computers and maybe they can, you know, create their own music. Our users might say, you know, I need these scans of a really rare or fragile book or image or something scanned. Or they might say, you know, I'd really love to be able to look at things in your collection, but, you know, I'm located in another state and, you know, I need stuff for research. So I think our technology tends to skew toward access. Access and the cataloging portion of it, how we catalog our collections through accessioning. I do think that, you know, we try, we make every effort to make sure that those things are updated.
Do you feel like you got good education in library school on archives specifically, or have you picked up a lot of that on the job itself?
I do think that I got a good intro to it at Simmons, definitely. Simmons has an archives management program. It was one of their specialties. It was kind of the reason I had narrowed down on them as one of my choices. So they have that option. You have to do these internships as part of your degree. So I definitely feel like I got good introductions to it in that way. But certainly, yeah, I think it's like all things. You learn better just on the job by doing it. You can practice, you know, processing a collection, or you can practice writing a finding aid. But it's not until you're actually in there every single day doing it, every single day researching, every single day writing, that you finally kind of get the hang of it.
Can you talk a little bit about the work that you did at your previous jobs? Like you mentioned you worked at Tufts and Harvard Medical School and Lexington
Sure.
Public Library.
So that was interesting. Tufts, I want to say Tufts was like the first sort of job that I had in the archives. the first like pay job in the archives. And so there I was working on a grant funded project, and they were creating a series of linked data biographies or historical sketches about buildings on campus and people related to these buildings on campus. You know, Tufts was an old school, and many of the buildings on campus, I think like all old schools, you had departments that started out in one building and maybe it moved. One building maybe used to be where the janitors were at with the physical plant, and then eventually that turned into like a math department, and then maybe the math department morphed into the engineering building, et cetera, et cetera. So they were working on this really neat project that was designed to sort of link the histories of all of these buildings and all of these people whom buildings were named after. So that was my job. I researched the history of the buildings, and I created biographical or historical sketches for all of those things. And then they were linked in the linked inside the content management system. The work now at Harvard, that was an interesting situation, because I came in again on a grant project, and I started out in the archives at the medical school. It's called the Center for the History of Medicine, and that's at their Countway Library, which is located in the medical district. So it's that particular situation on the whole was unique, because it was the only Harvard library not located in Cambridge. We were, as a medical library located by all of the hospitals to better serve our patrons. So I did start out there in the archives, and really just doing like digitization projects and things of that nature. And I had the opportunity once the grant ended to work upstairs in access services. Somebody was going on maternity leave. They needed somebody. And I had been recommended for it. So that seemed to me like a really great opportunity, where even though I had been trying to maintain this archives focus, I still also wanted to sort of ensure my relevancy in the job market. And so I decided to then take the job in access services, because I figured I could learn, even more and add even more to this skill set. Plus, I did really enjoy working with people. And that was the thing that I'd missed about being in journalism. I missed like interviewing people and talking to people on the phone and going to meet sources and stuff. So access services was an opportunity for me to kind of get that back, and get that public service thing going.
And then the Lexington Public Library?
Yeah. Then I was, I know, it's crazy. It feels like I've had a lot of jobs. So I moved to Kentucky, and that was an interesting situation. I mean, Kentucky was not necessarily on my radar, shall we say. And
I was actually wondering that. Are you from that area at all? Or
I am not. I am not from that area. Long story short, I met a great guy. And he was also a journalist. We met at a journalism conference, and it became clear, and certainly I understood the politics and the nature of journalism, which is that you wouldn't tell someone who had a steady job at a newspaper, hey, drop this and leave it and come move out here with me. If they have a good journalism job and no other offers anywhere else, they should keep that good journalism job. And as an additional factor, he also has a daughter from his previous marriage. So there were just a lot of factors that made it so that I knew that I would have to be the one to move. And interestingly enough, I was kind of planning to leave Boston anyway, because Boston is really expensive. It's so expensive. And I kind of felt like I was barely keeping up with that. I suppose if I had, reached out and gotten a second job or something, I maybe could have. But I always knew that my time there was finite, just because the city was so expensive. So, the universe mix some things up, and all of a sudden I was presented with this opportunity to move to Kentucky. So that was an interesting situation for me in that I had, prior to, you know, meeting this person and doing these things, I had not scoped out the job market before that point. I didn't know. So I started looking for jobs almost right away, like almost as I knew I was going to move. And that process took about, I looked for about 9 months, and mostly trying to apply to either the large university, UK, and the public library, because at that point I had those two sets of experience. I had volunteered at the Chicago Public Library, so I had, you know, I had a little bit of public library experience going on, but then I also had worked in the academic library setting. So I had these things happening, and finally, I got to town and I left for a weekend. Maybe I was there 2 weeks, and I left for a weekend and finally got a call back from the public library that Sunday. So I was very excited because I think public librarianship, it kind of gets at the essence of librarianship. You know, most of us, when we're young, that's your introduction to what libraries are. You go to the public library with your parents, you're checking out books, they're telling you about it at school. You don't know when you're 9 what a systems librarian is or does. You have no clue about that. You know who the people are who stand at the desk and help you check your books out. So
yeah, what's an archivist, mommy?
I have had to explain that, actually. I did an elevator pitch at the Society of American Archivists conference 1 year, and I based it on what I would tell a 6-year-old, because my fiance's daughter, she knew what I did when I was at the public library. It was very clear. But once I started working at UK, that was her question. Like, what is an archivist? What is that? I don't know. I don't know what you do. So the pitch that I told her, which I suppose I could share, was I said archivists are people who take old things and create new stories about them. The new stories essentially being the research that you would, the research that you would create after using archival materials and primary source materials. Now, of course, that's simplifying it. I mean, obviously, we do born digital materials. Much has certainly been made of Clinton's emails and her server and the 30,000 emails that she deleted. So that is a great concern to archivists, because those are the types of things that we are, that we are trying to collect and preserve.
Funny with things like that, archivists freak out about a completely different part of it than politicians do. Like, oh no, it's not being preserved. Is what we're
yeah. I mean, well,
improper preservation.
If you're thinking about it critically too, like, and we've talked about this in terms of critical librarianship, or thinking about yourself as like a critical thinking archivist or a radical archivist, you do definitely think about it in terms of outside of just the basic preservation of it. You also think about it in terms of, you know, what does this do for government transparency, and what does it do for, you know, the rights of the people to know what their elected representatives
are up to.
So there's that. So the public I was at the public library part time, and I had also gotten a part time job at Transylvania University, which is, interestingly enough, one of the oldest university in Kentucky. It was built in the late 1700s. So I was working there part time as a reference librarian. So, did those things part-time, got a bunch of new experiences, new skills, just different things to learn, always different things to learn. And then finally, this job got posted at UK that I was really excited about. I felt like I could be bang up at this job. I was so excited about it. And it was, they were creating what they call the Learning Lab. So it's basically an archives internship for undergraduates. And undergraduates who undergraduates who are not necessarily interested in library science, just graduates from undergrads from different disciplines. So I had kids who, I had a couple kids who were history majors. I had a couple kids who, you know, I had kids who wanted to be teachers, so they were going into education. I had a fine arts major. Interestingly enough, after the internship, she decided that she wanted to do archives. So she has gone on to do the program at University of Pittsburgh. But yeah, I was so excited by that because it just, it combined a lot of things that I liked. I do tend to place a heavy emphasis on technology in my particular job, and I've been very supported by that, by my supervisors. So the kids have been doing, I think what leans more toward like digital humanities projects, because part of the internship is not just that they learn about archives and processing a collection and writing and finding it, but that they also have to create a scholarly project at the end of the year. It's a year-long internship. So they create the scholarly project and then they present it at the end of the year. And it could be anything, you know, they could do a poster or they could present at a conference. They could write a paper and try to get it published. The students of mine who wanted to be teachers, they created a full curriculum and also used the assessment tools that we use in the libraries based off the ACRL standards. So it was just a really neat exercise to try to figure out what they all liked and how it was applicable through archives. So
was this a new thing that had just been created, or
this was new? Yes, and I'm told we're still only one of the few schools that is doing that, and especially for undergrads. There are programs that exist like that for the teachers, definitely, but for undergraduates, a lot harder. Being able to work with the students, mentoring, you know, really being able to get into that mentorship role, sitting down with them one-on-one and talking out the projects, talking out the things that they've learned, having discussions about it, and then seeing them apply that and take it to the next level. I love that.
Yeah, it's always, that's the one thing that I like about, I'm in management now at my public library, but it's sort of, you always want to have that one-on-one with people as much as possible, because you really want to work with the people that you're helping, because, I mean, it's obviously important once you get up into administration and stuff that you're doing important things, but I like that face-to-face kind of stuff. So.
Absolutely. So that has been great. And it also, so I think just because of the nature of it, you know, the students, once they start working on their projects, you know, we're still sort of checking in, but then there's a certain point at which I'm a bit hands off. So I think one of the other awesome things about it is that my boss has been really awesome about allowing me to explore these other aspects of academic librarianship. So I've been able to help, help pull grants together, and help do research and help do exhibits and join me, the information literacy working group, taking the teaching. I've been able to start teaching. So that was really interesting. I mean, it wasn't anything that I necessarily came into the field expecting to do, but I had been given opportunities to do it over time. So I recently taught the Archives and Manuscripts Management class at UK in their School of Library Information Science. So that was pretty fun as well, but also challenging because it's an online program. And at least in the program I had, you know, we'd come to look at archives as this very hands-on discipline. Like, you need to be there, you need to touch the stuff, and you need to be able to assess it properly and, you know, figure out what it is and why it's important, and here's how you make it accessible to researchers. It was a great challenge, and I enjoyed doing it, and the students, you know, I got good feedback from it. So I guess that's always good. You want good feedback when you're in the classroom. Want to know you're not screwing them up or steering them wrong.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about access in sort of like, now in the 21st century, when people can't go get these things, how do you make more things more accessible in archives when you can't necessarily come touch it? I mean, before it was always kind of you had to be careful with touching archives if it was old enough, things like that. But how do you make things more accessible, especially in the digital world?
Well, that is a great question. You know, one of the questions that we are frequently asked is, how come it's not all online? How come you haven't digitized it all? So as someone who has worked on myriad digitization projects, you know, it costs a lot of money and it takes a lot of time to do that. One of the simplest ways I could explain that is this idea of digital time suck, which I hadn't considered this concept. And I heard a really great talk about it at SAA by some archivists who work at Wayne State in Michigan. And so they were saying that essentially when you do a digitization project, it takes, you know, it takes so many seconds or so many minutes for an image to actually scan. And then once the image is scanned, you know, it takes so many more minutes to maybe like adjust it or crop it or do whatever you have to do there and then resave it. And get your naming conventions all together and, you know, all of these various things, which, you know, the seconds add up into minutes, the minutes into hours. And before you know it, you know, you have spent a crazy number of weeks on like not that many images. So it just, given the sheer volume of materials that we have, I mean, it would be almost impossible to try to digitize all of it. So we do try to, certainly we try to create access digitally, but especially here in Kentucky, I mean, we have a situation where we have very poor broadband access throughout the state. So, you know, we could throw up a bunch of digital libraries, but, you know, do our immediate patrons who we serve in the Commonwealth, do they all have equal access to the internet? No, they do not. So we try to create access in different ways. I think primarily we do a really great job at reference. We get all kinds of phone calls, especially, or researchers who will come in, especially with genealogy. You'll get researchers who come in and they, you know, they're from various parts all over the state. Sometimes, you know, sometimes even from around the country, they're coming in to see stuff. And I think we do a really great job of, you know, communicating with them and making sure they have what they need when they arrive. I think that that face-to-face in-person access is just as important as anything that we could put online.
Is your special collections open to just students and researchers, or can people from the public come?
We are open to the public, absolutely, which is another thing I think is great. I think this, and this was sort of borne out by my experience at the public library here, but I think that Kentuckians are avid library users. They utilize library services and they utilize the archives. I think when they know that we're here and they know what we're doing, they're here. They're here for it. So, yeah, I think that just plays into it. That's a big part of it.
Does your archives where you are now, do they have any particular specialty that you would want to talk about? Any special collection that is unique to them?
Well, I mean, we definitely have a really strong collection of like pre and post Civil War materials. We have a really strong collection of Appalachian region materials. We actually just got a really huge CLEAR grant to process a collection of materials related to social justice groups who were trying to do work after Johnson announced the war on poverty. So we have, you know, that's something I'm not necessarily directly working with that, though certainly there's possibilities for my particular program to look at some of those materials after they've been processed for the grant and stuff. But that's something that I'm really excited about because it's so huge and it's still so relevant here in Kentucky today. I mean, we're still talking about the war on poverty and what it means. And again, there's my excitement about the patterns of history. Like we talked about this a long time ago and now we're still talking about it. It's still very relevant. So being able to look back historically and see, okay, these were the things that people did before. Did they work? Did they bear out? And if they did work, you know, why is poverty still such a huge issue here?
In addition to all those, I mean, into seeing all these patterns and things, I think you even mentioned in some of the emails we exchanged before we started that cultural preservation was a big part of what interested you in archives. Can you talk a little
Absolutely.
Bit about that?
Absolutely. Well, cultural preservation, that's something I've explored a lot in a casual and even in a more scholarly way, because I think that's the biggest part about archives. They tell us essentially who we were, and I think to a greater extent who we could be. So with cultural preservation, I think what we're trying to do in the archives is make sure those things aren't lost. And what are the types of things that reveal culture to us? You know, a series of collected musical scores, for instance, by a local composer. You know, what might that music tell us about? You know, tell us about a period of time in this country's history, or why? You know, why music was written a certain way. Why did we end up moving from like the big band era to the jazz era, then to rock and roll? Like, you know, how do we see those links and make those connections? And I think that archives are a big part of helping us capture that. Socially, what I think has been very interesting, especially when we're talking about born digital materials, is you know, when we're talking about things like social media, for instance, and the manner in which that's being archived, what we're seeing here now is unprecedented, because archives have traditionally, you know, it's been said that history is written by the winners. So archives have tended to be very heavy on collections, you know, of dead white men, essentially. So what's been happening on social media is unprecedented, because what is being archived is not just the voices and perspectives of this tiny group of dead white men. You have all sorts of voices chiming into the fray now with their opinions, their perspectives on history. And it's beautiful, and it's messy, and it's complex, but it's also really exciting, because it's a chance to fully expand the narrative from what it's been for so many years, to being more inclusive.
And like you said, it's messy, but history, real life is messy. So.
Absolutely, absolutely. Real life is messy. The idea that we could even think or hope to distill it just in these very narrow experiences or perspectives is pretty crazy. So I think archives, where they can, you know, they try to get a variety of those experiences. Now, certainly, if you have a subject specific archives, you're not going to do that. But you know, I think like a university like ours is certainly making attempts to try to be as inclusive as possible about the histories that it's collecting and preserving.
And do you think that's what ties into the idea of ethical stewardship, of doing it in a way that is inclusive and including everybody? Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. You know, so a very interesting, I guess an interesting perspective is that, so before I came here, you know, and I'm not a native Kentuckian, the university did have a somewhat contentious relationship with local communities of color. And I don't think that that's anything that was unique to University of Kentucky. I mean, once I got here, I started meeting people, you know, and Black people especially, who had been maybe some of the first Black students to integrate the University of Kentucky. So their memories of what happened on campus are far different, I think, than other students might have been. So when it comes to, you know, maybe trying to approach that group of people to say, hey, you know, your histories and your stories and your collections are really, really important, and we'd be honored to be the stewards of that. When we say that to those groups, you know, it takes a bit more conversation, and it takes a bit more outreach, because those are groups who have, you know, very good reason to be somewhat wary of the university's interest in their things. So I think that absolutely, you know, being being and presenting yourselves and in practice as well as being ethical stewards of the materials that you have and that you're preserving. That's incredibly important. And I think it's a really big part of having that complete picture. You know, everybody's histories are important. We are trying to preserve, collect and preserve, you know, the histories of everyone in the Commonwealth, not just, you know, not just the tiny group of dead white men.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, man, I know that once I sort of got my brain around some of the things that you're not sort of in high school when you start breaking down those easy stories that you learn in elementary school about how the country was founded. I found it actually more interesting when you had to learn about these conflicts that they had about slavery and things like that, of creating the country of, but we have this larger good of wanting to create this country, but we have this other thing. That kind of stuff is more interesting to me, is when you have these conflicts, that to have that eliminated from when you're a kid to learn is just sad.
Absolutely. I mean, interestingly enough, I did an outreach program last year, and it was based on this Wikipedia entry that I had read about Daniel Boone. And it was, the entry itself was worded so problematically in the early part of the text. And it says something like, you know, Daniel Boone was this trailblazer and yada, yada, yada. And so it sets up, you know, just very briefly, it said, well, you know, he, you know, helped found the state of Kentucky or the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and he did all these things, you know, and it said he started acquiring land in the state, and the wording was after like a brief skirmish or something. It was something very odd that minimized the interactions that he had with native groups across the state. And I was reading it like, whoa, are you for real? He had a skirmish? Like, no, this was war. And you essentially came in and told people who were here that they had to go because you're building Kentucky. So from that, I came up with this idea of doing a project where you would explore movies and popular culture based on primary source materials that you could find in the archives. So I found a copy of Daniel Boone Trailblazer, and which is a really awful movie. It's terrible. Like any and all of like the bad, awful stereotypes that you could think of, you know, like settlers and Native Americans, like all of it. It's bad. It's really terrible. But one of the more interesting things about that movie is that I think in the popular imagination, Daniel Boone has come to be portrayed as like this really, you know, outdoorsy, like, you know, big brawny dude that got him, you know, he's always got he had the coonskin hat on, and, you know, he's mixing it up and scrapping it up. In an actual photo of Daniel Boone, he just, you know, he kind of looked like George Washington. I mean, he was kind of a genteel dude. He had the, you know, the wig. And he wore the colonial garb and stuff. So this idea of him as a strapping outdoorsman, I mean, even that is, it's false in the popular imagination. But, you know, if you go through the archives, you can see what that dude looked like and how his actual experiences don't necessarily square with how you ended up seeing him portrayed in popular media. So the series was using a bunch of different movies and then going through collections that we had in our archives to say, hey, here's where this movie might have gotten some things right. Or, hey, here's where this movie just like screwed it up. Like Daniel Boone Trailblazer! ! I'm pretty certain there's an exclamation point after it. Daniel Boone Trailblazer! !
It really needs that little shrug emoticon thing.
It does. I mean, it's insane. so yeah, I love being able to use the archives for things like that, to constantly sort of question, you know, what's real, what's accurate, from whose perspective is this story being told?
You mentioned this a little bit before, that we're still sort of doing that today, even with current culture, that it's still dominated by certain groups. But things like social media are helping to break through that. And
absolutely.
That ties into, I think, what I wanted to ask. The last thing I wanted to ask you about was the presentation you did at South by Southwest about Twitter activism and libraries. Can you talk a little bit about what you talked about there?
Sure, sure. Well, so I was presenting on a panel with Dr. Mark Anthony Neal, who is a professor of African-American studies at Duke University, and Dr. Meredith Clark, who is a professor at University of North Texas in Denton. She teaches journalism. And so we sort of took the approach that we took the approach as information professionals. So I was the librarian archivist. At the time, Meredith was still a working journalist, and then she had a column for a newspaper in North Carolina. And then Professor Neal, who is an educator. So we were taking the tack of how information professionals can sort of harness the power of social media to do their job and deliver information to the masses, essentially. So from the libraries and archives standpoint, I was trying to argue that, you know, I realize one of the things that I think makes us great is that, you know, we're supposed to be giving access to things in a democratic way, that, you know, everybody's supposed to get this information. That's the library standpoint. So one of the things that I used as an example in the talk that I'd done as a librarian was when I was at Harvard in Access Services, I was in charge of the Twitter account. And which in hindsight seems like a really big, a really big thing to have been in charge of so early in the game. But I had a great boss and he trusted me a lot. So I was in charge of the Twitter account. And in one of the first instances of activism among certain groups on Twitter that I saw was the publicized journalists that I knew were publicizing this upcoming execution of Troy Davis, who was a man in Atlanta, Georgia. And, you know, much doubt had been cast upon his conviction anyway. So just before the execution, his situation was getting a lot of media attention. And that's where I saw journalists and then other grassroots organizations start really harnessing Twitter to use it and discuss what was happening and say, you know, hey, this probably shouldn't be happening. Not even probably, like, this shouldn't be happening at all. This man should not be executed. So what I did, because I wanted to still have the Twitter space be somewhat objective in nature. I mean, obviously, this is a large university. I knew that it would have been inappropriate for me to go making personal statements, you know, whatever my personal beliefs were about the death penalty. So what I then did was I started going through our collection and our catalog, and I started posting links to articles and books and journals that we had. Being at a medical library, there was quite a bit of information on doctors who, you know, either chose to, what's the word that I'm looking for? Not super... Well, I guess it is kind of supervised. You have doctors who have to stand in when an execution happens. So there was literature available at the library for doctors who were interested. So I found information on that, and I found articles that, you know, pointed to articles that talked about the drugs and chemicals that are used during executions and things like that. Because I figured, okay, if people are talking about this, you know, here's my opportunity to point them to some materials that are like really official in nature and that could really help understand and give context to this conversation that they're having. And I can do this without necessarily injecting my personal views, which, you know, some people could find, you certainly would run the risk of, like, you know, offending people or drawing negative attention to your library. And really what you want to do is just make sure that you're giving people the information that they need, information that they can use. So I think that was one very simple way that you do have that ability to help serve people in a manner that doesn't trample on their right to have whatever opinions they want to have, but in a way that also helps them be better informed when they are making these opinions. You know, another thing I could point to was from the archive side was that I was working with Radical Reference and another group of librarians on the Occupy Boston site, and we had the Occupy Boston A to Z Library. The A was for Audre Lorde, and the Z was for Howard Zinn, both of whom were librarians. And you know, it was very important for us to have that inclusive focus, not just have it be this this movement that was, you know, focusing on one group of people, but that, you know, the knowledge that we were going to have inside this library was, you know, was going to be inclusive. We wanted that from the start. It was very important to us. So from the archive standpoint, and we've been revisiting the archives because now it's time to talk long-term stewardship, but it was very important to us to make sure that we were capturing these things that were happening on the ground and in the camp. So, so collected were posters, you know, and notes about certain like committee meetings that were being had, because they, you know, they really documented what was going on in the camps from a variety of different perspectives. There was, you know, there were certain groups who felt like, hey, you know, this movement is maybe only focusing on this group of people and not being inclusive of this other group of people. So we're going to have a meeting about it. So by simply collecting the flyers discussing that meeting, you know, you're making sure to include that, hey, these other people were part of this movement as well. And, you know, there was a discussion had about the ways in which we could help make them more inclusive. So certainly from the archive standpoint, I think if you're hands-on and on the ground, you're trying to think about things with a critical mindset, you have that ability to say, you know, this is important. Let's make sure we're including as much of this as we possibly can so that the whole story of this is told.
That's excellent. Stacey, thank you so much for talking to me. And can you tell the audience if there's how they can get in touch with you, Twitter handle, anything like that?
Sure, sure. Well, I stay on the Twitter. My handle is Rybrarian, Wribrarian.
All right, excellent. And thank you so much for talking to me. I think it was a great discussion.
Oh, thank you, Steve, very much.
All right, bye-bye. If you'd like to learn more about the show or listen to past episodes, you can visit circulatingideas.com or follow us on Twitter at CircIdeas. We're also on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com, or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can drop us a line at mail@circulatingideas.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas.
You know, it's funny. I sort of came into listening to podcasts kind of late. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly I knew about like This American Life and stuff like that, but right. I had only recently started listening to them. So I felt like perhaps I had heard about your podcast, or I'd had a very ambient awareness about it. But it wasn't until I saw the call go out on Twitter, and it right. just happened to coincide with this time that I had also been listening to a lot of podcasts where it was like, oh, okay.
It coincided well.
it coincided very well.